As I have already warned some of you, I'm going to talk this morning. I hope I can finish time for discussion, but if not, I hope that we can talk about this tomorrow. I want to argue a thesis that I think is true and very important. Someone asked me, I was talking to someone yesterday, said he couldn't be here, he went on to say, and I ran through this with him, and he wanted to know where I got it from. But I'm afraid I can't answer that question exactly. I got it from a variety of sources. I don't know what your inspiration was, but may be original. Very little of it is original, I'm sure. But anyway, we were talking yesterday about the student revolt on the college campuses and what it means. And I suggested that there was a standard explanation which runs along the lines that students today are more involved. And this accords with the McLuhan thesis. You know, electric technology extended the nervous system and made the world a village, and students today want roles and they're deeply involved and committed and all that. And we talked about that and we cast a few doubts on it and looked at some evidence to support it. And then at the end of the session, I suggested an alternative explanation of the whole thing. Drawing on the Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset, I suggested that maybe the student revolt represents the revolt of the masses, that the revolt of the masses has reached even into the universities. Now, I happen to think this is true, and that for this reason, we are in very serious trouble. The student revolt, unfortunately, don't see too many of the student revolters here this morning. I wish they were, because they're the ones who react very violently to an argument such as this. But the student revolt, the revolt on university campuses, and the way in which some faculty members have responded to this indicates to me that some of the most important premises of the university and of a liberal democratic tradition are being abandoned. This is, I think, a grave crisis. To begin with, I want to explain what I mean by a university. Universities are committed essentially to a process. That process is dialogue. Universities are committed to absolutely no conclusion. Therefore, when you hear people saying that universities must take a stand on the major issues of the day, I could not disagree more. Universities can take no stand. Universities arrive at no conclusion. They are committed to a process. Individual scholars, they arrive at conclusions, of course, students, faculty. But the process is always kept open. And if ever the university says, here is the truth, it closes the dialogue. The people for whom a university primarily exists are the faculty and the students, because they make up the community of inquirers. A university is committed to those values, essentially committed to those values which Jacob Bronowski, in his book Science and Human Values, has identified with the rise of science. These values, I think, go much further than just science, both vertically and horizontally. They go much further back in time. They extend much further than just throughout the community of scientists. But these values include a passion for truth. Truth as experienced fact. What Bronowski calls, using an interesting metaphor from the monastery, the habit of truth. The community of inquirers in the university put on a habit of truth. A university is committed to tolerance and indeed even the welcoming of dissent as something which is absolutely essential for free inquiry. It is committed to respect for each participant in the quest for truth. It follows from this, and from my understanding of liberal democracy, that universities are essential liberal democratic institutions. The values of liberal democracy are the values of the university, and that they are going to stand and fall together. And what I'm afraid of is that today, in our society, they are falling together. Now, after this introduction about universities, I want to talk about the liberal democratic tradition. The question I was raised, what do I mean by the liberal democratic tradition? I'm simply going to define it, first of all, in terms of individuals who have stood in it. The liberal democratic tradition is the tradition of Thomas Jefferson, John Stuart Mill, Lord Acton, Edmund Burke, taking some people in our time today who seem to be at the opposite ends of the political spectrum. Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist who was economic advisor to Barry Goldwater. He stands in the Liberal Democratic Commission. Michael Harrington, who is the author of The Other America, and who has proposed all kinds of schemes that Friedman abominates, he is in the Liberal Democratic tradition. Why? Because the Liberal Democratic tradition is a tradition rooted in certain premises, and both Friedman and Harrington accept these premises. Let me try to indicate these premises. First of all, that this is not an exhaustive list. But one very important premise is that justice, which is the main concept of the political order, justice is some kind of objective reality. Justice is something that finally judges us. It is not just something that we create or that we discover. It is something that we discover. It's not something that we create. Furthermore, the liberal democratic tradition is committed to the view that each man is tempted to distort his vision of justice and to identify it with his subjective interest. Another premise, because man is a rational animal, he is capable of transcending himself, of going beyond himself, and employing justice with a capital J to correct his own partial apprehension of justice. In other words, man is capable of being critical of his own interests. The process whereby this occurs is political discourse, or moral discourse, or dialogue. Political discourse, moral discourse, dialogue, is the necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of a democracy. So I'm defining democracy in the way in which I think the best minds among political philosophers have defined it. Democracy is government by dialogue, government by discourse. Okay, in a society now where truth is taken to be nothing but subjective preference, or a society where the essential rationality of man is denied. In such a society, I argue, universities make no sense, and democracy ceases to be possible. I want to try to make this vivid and concrete if I can. First of all, I wonder if you're aware of the extent to which the objective nature of truth is denied in our society today, and how many different circles it's denied. I wonder if you've ever noticed how reason has been dismissed and is continually dismissed by the best minds of our time as mere rationalization. But when somebody gives reason, we have a tendency to say, and then we look for the hidden, say, the psychological conditioning, or if someone says, I believe firmly, then we look to see what his socioeconomic position is, to see why he believes it. We tend to assume that when men give reasons for their behavior, they're really offering rationalization. You're just covering up. In a society where all reasons are taken to be rationalization, where reason itself is kind of viewed with suspicion, and where people, all the emphasis is placed just on technique, so that, for example, in political science itself, reason is in eclipse, and what political scientists do is run around and count noses or survey opinions. In a society where all values are assumed to be relative, so where you can't really talk about what is good, but only about what certain people think is good, where the distinction between good and evil is finally considered to be just a matter of personal prejudice. In such a society, I do not believe that a democracy can long exist. What it all comes to, I think, is that we have become a society of absolute relativists. There is one absolute in the modern intellectual community, and that is relativism. That's an odd phrase, absolute relativism, but I think it fits. But in the political moral realm, which is the realm I want to talk about, we are, oddly enough, relativists in principle. but we are absolutists in practice. And this is a corollary and a consequence, I think, of our relativism in principle. In principle, we say everything is relative. And when we get down to practice and down to cases, we become hard-nosed, dogmatic absolutists. And I don't think that this is accidental. The liberal democratic tradition, on the other hand, the one in which we were all reared, demands quite the reverse. It demands that we be absolutists in principle and relativists in practice. Now, why do you find, or is it true that you find these pairs associated in this peculiar way? I think it is true, and the reason is quite simple. If you believe that there is no objective justice, that, you know, when somebody says, justice demands that we pass such and such a law, you say, well, justice doesn't demand anything. This guy wants it, and he wants it because, you know, he's a member of a liberal Presbyterian church, and liberal Presbyterians feel they owe it to their position in society to be unfair. Now, you're always looking for rationalizations. You know, you don't assume that there is anything out there, justice, to which we can all refer and judge what we do and judge our society. In such a climate, then when opinions differ, what can we do? There are only two things we can do. We can ignore the differences if they don't matter, or we can submit them to the test of force if they do. Somebody says, justice demands open occupancy legislation. And someone else says, justice demands that every individual be free to sell his house or rent his house to whomever he pleases. Now, if there is no thing called justice to which we can refer in this disagreement, the only things we can do ultimately are say, well, it doesn't matter. Being indifferent about it, everybody goes their own way. Of course, to be indifferent usually is to make a decision. But if it really matters, finally, we have to fight about it. We put it to a test of force. So, if I feel very strongly that a certain policy is unjust, and I maintain that this is ultimately only the way I feel, I say, well, this is my taste, this is my personal preference, then I fight. If I feel strongly, but it's only my preference, then I have to fight. And what I do is I marshal all the force I can to put down opposing views. And if somebody comes forward with an opposing view, I get indignant. I hate to use examples close at home, but I thought the other night, well, when you said something up there in the balcony, and you offended some very strong feelings, and man, the reaction you got there. I was afraid for a while that this fight was going to break out, weren't you? No. But there was obviously we felt strongly, but fortunately, I understand dialogue was restored, wasn't it? Until 2:30 in the morning. There's an old phrase, de gustibus non disputandum. There's no arguing about tastes. Well, if there's no arguing about tastes, then we have to fight about them. Of course, the other alternative is to say that I don't give a damn. So we vacillate, and this is what I notice in our society, and what I notice also among students. They're vacillating between apathy, indifference, and violence, between no action and direct action, between indifference and coercion, between, in the larger society especially, the abandonment of political life in a kind of suburban privatism, and the abandonment of democratic political life through techniques of rule or ruin. We swing between these extremes. We either say, well, tastes differ and I just don't want to get involved, and so we retreat. Or we say, tastes differ and I feel strongly, and so we get in there and use every technique, fair or unfair, in order to have our way, beat our opponents down. So we become, see, absolutists in practice. But now suppose that you're an absolutist in principle, not in practice. You believe that in principle there is something, justice with a capital J up there, to which all men can refer to judge themselves and their society. Suppose that you believe in the essential rationality of man. You refuse to assert that all reasons are just rationalizations. then I think you're going to say a number of things. You're going to say that you're going to say that what you believe to be just refers to something that is really just. However, you're going to add, I may not have seen justice with complete clarity. And you're going to enter into dialogue with other people in order to correct your own notions, but also because you think that what you've seen is really out there, because you think there really is a difference between justice and injustice, you are going to want to explain to other people how this is so and why it is so and that it is so. If you believe firmly, for example, that a society in which men are segregated in their living patterns according to skin color is an unjust society, you will want to explain to others why this is so. And because you believe it is really so, you'll believe that you can explain it to them rationally. You'll believe that when an individual differs from you, there's an error involved. And that error can be corrected through the process of dialogue, moral discourse. You will listen to other people, though, too, because you'll know that they, too, have had some kind of vision of justice. Your dialogue will be a dialogue and not a monologue. And you will want your own vision of justice to be corrected and made more adequate. And as a consequence, your absolutism in principle leads, I think, to a relativism in practice. And you will then reject apathy, a policy of no action, indifference, privatism, because justice makes demands upon you. You won't be able to go out into your little suburb or hang out in your fraternity house and say, oh, I don't give a rip, don't bother me with all of that stuff, because you're aware of the demands that justice makes upon you. At the same time, you will reject violence, direct action, coercion, the philosophy of rule or ruin, because you know that you haven't seen everything that justice requires. Now, this may sound like I'm rejecting civil disobedience, which sounds like direct action, violence. I'm not. And I want to make this even more concrete by examining the phenomenon of civil disobedience in the light of the liberal democratic tradition. You see, I'm assuming, I hope this is correct, that the student revolt today is fundamentally a manifestation of civil disobedience. And what the students are essentially doing is saying, these laws or rules about the draft or the rules that the administration lays down or building a gymnasium in land where Negro children ought to be allowed to play, this is all done by rule in accord with law. And the students are saying the laws, the rules are unjust and we will openly disobey them. This is a form of civil disobedience. Well, now, I think we can get a handle on the student revolt by looking at the phenomenon of civil disobedience. In debates over civil disobedience today, I usually focus, of course, on the question either of Vietnam or civil rights, there are always two positions that emerge. On the one hand, you have people saying, you've got to obey the law. You must always obey the law. If you don't agree with the law, you, in a democracy, you have the right to try to change it. But you've got to change it within the rules. You have no right to say, because I don't agree with this law, therefore I'm going to disobey it. Obey the powers that be. The powers that be are ordained of God. If every man assumes for himself the right to disobey any law with which he doesn't agree, anarchy and chaos. You know the argument, all right? The other argument is everyone has, no one should obey an unjust law. And usually these people aren't quite as loquacious. But they just state it flatly. If a law is unjust, you must disobey. Now, the trouble with neither of these positions seems really to be tenable on examination. You take that first position, obey the law because it is the law. I don't think any of us really believes it. Certainly, you can't believe it if you stand within the liberal democratic tradition. After all, in our own tradition, at its very root, Jefferson and Franklin and Washington and Adams kind of disobeyed the law. They revolted. They said this is unjust. And if you're a good biblicist or a fundamentalist, you not only have St. Paul saying be obedient to the powers because they're ordained of God, you also have the statement it is better to obey God than man. And even my grade school teacher, who was he was absolutely ferocious about obeying the government, no kind of disobedience. He was sort of consistent. He used to contend that the American Revolution was a sin. And he so hated Great Britain, though. I didn't know how he thought we could make recompense for this sin. But he instituted one sin. But he also said it is better to obey God rather than... So what you do, and see, in his tradition, is you obey all laws unless man's laws violate the will of God. Well, all right, that's the problem, isn't it? Right? Of course, he knew the law of God, about the only way he felt that man's laws could violate the laws of God, were if the government said you couldn't go to church. But now there are people who say, no, when the government passes a law that separates men in a demonic fashion, this is a violation of the law of God. When the government pursues a policy that, you know, kills babies and sacrifices innocent people to an imperialistic itch, this is a violation of the law of God. So, well, now, the trouble, of course, with the first position, you know, always obey the law, is that when the chips are down, none of us really holds to it. I think we all grant that there are circumstances in which we should disobey the law. Well, but is the answer, well, disobey unjust laws? Now, that doesn't work either. Who decides what an unjust law is? Individual conscience is what most people put forward, but this is anarchy. Yeah, I think we've got to face it, that it's anarchy. The trouble is, the people who are proposing this today haven't faced up to the fact that it's anarchy, because they're assuming that only the good people, which means the people who agree with them, will be running around asserting their conscience in the face of unjust laws. But we know what rationalizers men can be, and let's remember, not only have people claimed for themselves a right to disobey unjust laws about race and war, they've also claimed the right not to pay their income tax because the income tax is unjust. They've claimed the right to disobey civil rights legislation because this is an unjust usurpation of individual prerogative. There's hardly a law in our society, including the laws that say you have to slow down when you go through school zones, that some nut won't call unjust, and claim for himself the right in conscience to disobey. In fact, I think every time one of us gets stopped by a traffic cop, you see this coming into play. You know, I've been stopped a few times, but I rarely found an individual who felt that he wasn't the victim of injustice. And if there were a way that he could get out of obeying this law, he sure would. Now, the fact is that no political order can exist if it says every individual has the right to search his conscience to see whether it agrees with any law that is passed and to disobey those laws which are not in accord with his conscience. This is anarchy. Well, what do we have? On the one hand, people saying obey all laws, and that's untenable. On the other hand, people saying obey only just laws, and that's untenable. There is a third position, and I think if you examine the history of liberal democracy, you find this is the position of liberal democracy. It's a very simple one. Of course you obey the law. You obey the law for all the obvious reasons. It's a simple thing to do. It makes for order. It's a responsible thing. It's reasonable. Even when you don't agree. Until it becomes your duty to disobey. This is the essence of the liberal democratic tradition. Until it becomes your duty to disobey. You see, the word duty implies an obligation towards something outside of yourself. There is all the difference in the world between this and mere conscience. You've got to reflect on this now, because this is the heart of the matter. When you say, it is my duty to disobey, you are positing a ground for appeal. You are pointing to something beyond the law and beyond yourself to which you can appeal and which you are inviting other people in the society to look at also. You're saying there is something out there, something which is accessible to all of us, which demands of me that I disobey this law. There is something which stands in judgment over both the law and the disobeyer, which becomes the court of common appeal. You see the difference between this and saying, I disobey the law because it's against my conscience? Your conscience is private. But when you say it is my duty, you are pointing to an exterior obligation, and you're saying, no, we can talk about it because my action is related to something that is accessible to you. You assume the obligation when you disobey the law in the liberal democratic tradition of engaging in a rational defense of your actions. You want a beautiful example of this? Look at the Declaration of Independence, which is really a striking document, one of the most vivid and beautiful documents in the liberal democratic tradition. Whenever it becomes necessary for people to revolt, it is necessary that they declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And this is what the Declaration of Independence is. These men didn't say, our conscience says we're not going to put up with this. They said, this is contrary to justice, to the rights of man. You notice this ringing, these ringing statements about right and justice were objective reality. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Now this stuff is all in Eclipse. It isn't so evident after all. But these men believed in the existence of an order, a political order, which was guided by objective considerations of justice, things to which all men could appeal, which they could discuss rationally. And when they revolted, they went to that court. They called upon all rational men to consider the nature of justice and human rights, and to compare that with the situation in which they found themselves, and to agree with them that they were compelled to the separation. For an even more vivid example of someone acting in this fashion and disobeying on the basis of duty, not individual conscience, I invite you to consider the career of Martin Luther King, whose strategy was so thoroughly consistent with the liberal democratic tradition and so tragically misinterpreted by both his friends and his foes. You've got to go back and look at the strategy and the tactics that he employed time after time in his acts of civil disobedience. And then you see what I'm talking about. The friends of Martin Luther King like to say, he asserted the Christian conscience as superior to all law. He did no such thing. The foes of Martin Luther King said, he set himself above the law. He did not. What Martin Luther King did was call for discussion. He said, justice condemns this. He talked in these old-fashioned phrases about the natural law, the basic conceptions of human dignity. But he was telling all Americans, look, think, bring your own conceptions of justice and order, bring your own notion of the good life under judgment. Come, let us reason together. Martin Luther King said, I believe that you are rational. I believe that you, too, are guided by considerations of a justice which is exterior to yourself. And if I can make you reason together with me, you too will finally agree that this law is unjust, or that we need the passage of this just law. In all of his campaigns, this is what he did. He started off by focusing the issue. He tried to make it so perfectly clear what he was after and why he was after it. Then he called for dialogue with the relevant persons, the community leaders, government officials, leading businessmen, or whoever he was trying to influence. If he could not get the dialogue, then he began his program of disobedience. But he always was willing to stop the disobedience when discussion began. Martin Luther King was using disobedience as a tool of dialogue. Because sometimes in a society, we become so frightened or polarized that dialogue breaks down. And it may be necessary then for someone to restore that dialogue by a radical act of disobedience. But in the liberal democratic tradition, let us remember, when we put the disobeyer in jail, we still have the obligation to listen to him. The newspapers of Texas, or Dallas at least, infuriate me because they had gotten into the habit of talking about Martin Luther King as an ex-con. And so many of Martin Luther King's opponents. Simply, instead of respecting a man who was, if you looked at him at all, earnestly endeavoring to get people to talk about what our social institutions were doing to us, and his enemies would treat him not as a serious, courageous man who was willing to give his life for the cause in which he believed, but as some kind of nut who thought he was superior to everybody else and deserved what he got every time he got tossed in the clink. Sure, in our kind of society, we will jail the person who disobeys the law, because he disobeyed the law. But he's calling us to talk to him, and we must do so. Gandhi, of course, did the same, and the British, those marvelous liberal Democrats, they talked to Gandhi through his prison bars, and Gandhi convinced them. And Martin Luther King, I think, convinced a lot of Americans through his act of disobedience. I think he did initiate and restore dialogue. For King, as for any real believer in liberal democracy, disobedience can only be a part of discussion and can be justified only by the contribution that it makes to reopening discussion. But now, in an age where the possibility of rational dialogue is so often denied in principle, and where the objective character of justice and truth is systematically denied, especially by our best minds, there's no one to engage in moral discourse. Because, you know, nobody's really serious. Everybody's just a bundle of prejudices. So there's nobody to discourse, and because there's no objective justice, there's nothing to talk about. No one to talk, and nothing to talk about. I should have hoped that the universities, which are themselves essentially committed to the liberal democratic tradition, could have defended and supported this tradition in its time of crisis. But I'm afraid the universities have not taught that tradition to their students. More, and the evidence of it is that the better students today are the ones who are so often rejecting the liberal democratic tradition on the side of violence and direct action and coercion and rule or ruin. But we haven't taught it to the poor students either. The poorer students are rejecting the liberal democratic tradition, the great majority of the student body, on the side of apathy, non-action, indifference, and privatism. And I want to stress again, we have to keep this in mind. The great majority of students on our campuses are not in revolt. The great majority of them are interested still in getting pledged by a fraternity, getting the trade union card, passing principles of marketing, and building their barbecue grills. But I find even among the younger faculty, and this is one of the most disturbing things to me, there seems to be no appreciation of the liberal democratic tradition. The instructors, the teaching assistants, perhaps the assistant professors, they seem not to have learned this tradition either. And they are most busily engaged in fouling their own nest, in destroying the possibility of dialogue. But denying in practice the presuppositions that undergird their own activity, destroying academic freedom in the name of, it's hard to tell in the name of what they're destroying. But they're willing to suspend dialogue in order to secure their ends. You see, they become absolutists in practice. They think it's worthwhile suspending democratic processes, the process of moral and political discourse and genuine human dialogue. Worthwhile suspending that. Who cares if that all goes, if only we accomplish our objective? The objective is the thing. That's absolute. Is this now, as I suggested at the beginning, is this all a part of what Ortega y Gasset has called the revolt of the masses? And I'm afraid it shows most of the symptoms. Ortega says that the mass man, and that there are no political or economic connotations in this. For Ortega, the mass man is the individual who shows all these symptoms that I'm going to describe. Most basically, he is the man who refuses to put himself under discipline. He is the spoiled child, in Ortega's phrase. But all of these symptoms of the mass man that Ortega described back in 1930, I find evident today on university campuses. Disrespect for history. History can't teach us anything. I mean, that's all irrelevant. We the debunking school. That's what we do with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. All go back and debunk them. Sure, these men were human, like we are. But sometimes we act as if all they had were feet of clay. The rejection of discipline, including disciplined inquiry. I had a student this year, a brilliant student, who was supposed to do an independent study project. He wanted to do one on advertising. And he absolutely refused to do any research. He just had conclusions. And he was blasting them out in a beautiful purple prose. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. There's no sentence. I can go through it. Paragraph after paragraph is filled with ambiguous statements or erroneous statements. He said, you've got to get down. You've got to narrow down your topic. You've got to investigate. You've got to understand advertising before you can criticize it. He said, we've had enough of this analysis and careful inquiry. What our time needs is synthesis and programs. I never did convince him. He wound up getting an F on the paper. Well, he accepted. I did finally convince him, or at least he pretended to be convinced, that he did have to do a little disciplined inquiry, but he didn't have enough discipline to do it before the end of the semester. Another symptom Ortega talks about, fascination with techniques and little concern for the substance of technique. We all know how to drive cars, and none of us knows what makes them tick. We're all pushing buttons, and somebody says, now look, why don't you understand the little button? Don't bother me. And it goes much further than that. Radical ingratitude. You know, the college student today is the most pampered and privileged person in society. No, second most. The college faculty member is the most pampered and privileged. I answer, we are overpaid and underworked. I really think that the academic community is a marvelous, delightful place to be, and I am grateful for the fact that society allows me to be there and even pays me money to stay there, good money. But you find so little of this gratitude. Students are always griping. I'm not just thinking now about these students in revolt. It's the students not in revolt. They're griping too because the spaghetti got too much a garlic in it. The pettiest things they grab up. They're willing to blow the world up because the toilet doesn't flush in room 6. A rejection of all limitations. Men deny that they have any limitations. We resent anybody else doing something that we can't do. Let me in everywhere. I'm just as much of an expert as you are. Because this goes along with the rejection of the notion of expertise, of professionals. There are no professionals. Every man is an expert. The barbarism of specialization. This is the title of the chapter in Ortega's book, where society is being run by specialists who are complete barbarians. All they know is their narrow little corner of the universe and in a university community today. I remember sitting in a Marshall McLuhan. I was sitting in a doctoral exam a couple of weeks ago, and the student was being terribly confused. You couldn't tell what he was talking about. The examinee was firing things out from left field, right field. It was very vague, and I started thinking about McLuhan. I said, well, gee, he talks like McLuhan writes. And so I turned to a distinguished colleague on my right, and I said, I'm going to ask him what the significance of Marshall McLuhan is for economic theory. And this PhD of 10 years standing said, who's Marshall McLuhan? The last symptom that Ortega talks about that I find prevalent on the university campus is the rise of the spoiled masses. Yesterday, Harold here was objecting suggesting that the students who were revolting were spoiled children. I didn't mean that they were really spoiled children. I wasn't intending this as any kind of psychological judgment. I'll leave that up to Jerry. I was using an analogy. They are like spoiled children who have been given everything, and because they've been given everything, they're not grateful for anything. Ortega talks about the masses who are unintelligent enough to believe that the material and social organization placed at their disposition, like the air, is of the same origin. Or again, in regard to students, I so often think of this when I hear, well, just the other night when we were talking to some of these kids, they were disturbed about things that were going wrong. And I said, about the way one gal put it, everybody's forced to compete. So what they wanted to do was abolish the whole competitive system. You know, or in our political structure, every man doesn't have an equal voice with every man. So let's abolish the whole structure. Those students who want to destroy our systems because they have faults. Ortega writes, the new man wants his motor car and enjoys it, but he believes that it is the spontaneous fruit of an Edenic tree. In the depths of his soul, he is unaware of the artificial, almost incredible character of civilization, and does not extend his enthusiasm for the instruments to the principles which make them possible. I am much impressed with the incredible, artificial character of civilization. I am much impressed by the fact that we live together with tolerable justice and harmony and order and spontaneity and freedom, and produce so many motor cars, antibiotics, gewgaws and gadgets. I don't know whether that's why I'm such a strong believer in the liberal democratic tradition. I don't know what. Maybe deep down inside too, I'm committed to discourse because I think it's an extremely human thing. And I'm disturbed and frightened to see that the one place where discourse ought to be most sacred, where dialogue ought to be the supreme good, not to be threatened or challenged by anything, the university, that even here it's in place. We've got some time.
Wow. Paul, have you ever done any type of research in university riots back in the history?
No, I haven't.
But you might have. Hoping you might give us some background. I haven't. I'm completely ignorant.
I read those things every now and then, but nothing on my own.
Well, you probably appreciate the reason for the question.
Yeah.
Might throw some light on the outcome of the present things that are confronting universities apparently throughout the world. Whether this is some new cataclysmic phenomena or whether it's a sort of a seasoned phenomena that has come and gone as long as it's been schooled.
A couple of things can be said that I do know about. One is that in the many countries of the world, the university has not played the role that it plays in America and Great Britain, especially in Latin American countries. The university is conceived essentially different in Latin America, say. And that's one of the reasons that they have continual student riots and revolts in Latin America. And I remember not too many years ago, it was common for educators to say, isn't it marvelous that we have been delivered from that kind of thing? And now today you hear educators saying, isn't it marvelous that our students are beginning to get involved? I'd like to say, you mean that we're becoming like Latin American universities? Another thing, a few little student revolts of which I am were scattered through history. I think we're rooted in, I would like to believe, maybe that's why I see it this way. I think there's some grounds for the argument that the students were protesting that the university had ceased to be a university. That people weren't doing their jobs. The students were not being educated. That certain dogmatic opinions were being foisted upon them in the name of truth. And they were not being allowed to inquire freely. Some of the revolts in 18th century Britain, time Adam Smith was going to college, Oxford at that time was a real academic slum, and I don't think deserved the name of the university. And telling the student involved to make an attempt to restore the university to its essential function in nature.
Isn't this supposed to be the criticism level at the Sorbonne University now by the students and parents? That educators aren't doing their job, they're criticizing what's being offered, how it's being offered, facilities.
I certainly don't want to give the impression, Paul, here, that I'm satisfied with what the university is doing today. I'm not. I think a lot of the student protest is quite justified. The universities have become horribly bureaucratic and conservative, and they're repeating procedures that didn't work when they were first used, but they're the only procedures that the faculty knows. And maybe they're the only procedures that will preserve all the jobs of the present staff. I'm really happy to see students protesting this, but I insist that what they should be protesting against is the disappearance of genuine inquiry and dialogue, and to suspend free inquiry and dialogue in order to restore it is a very, very dangerous procedure. You know, to march into the president's office and shut down all the facilities of the university in the name of freedom. What's going on here?
Sometimes I wonder whether student revolts are because of boredom, because the students aren't students' interests aren't being held, students aren't being challenged. I often wonder whether this might be a part of the problem. Feel if they're in a situation of learning rather than intellectual challenge. I don't mean to say that a certain amount of rote learning isn't necessary.
Yeah. Well, this is a kind of, sort of Paul, an extension of Paul Goodman's thesis. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind by you today. We support people all the way up to the age of 21. You say you don't have to earn your own living, either your parents or a college scholarship. And now we say, but you engage in the activity of learning. And then learning is a meaningless activity. And they grow up absurd. They've got nothing meaningful to do. So they sit there in college and they're learning 17 principles of production management and firing these back on true false exams. So some students will drift off into apathy and go into fraternity houses and have a ball and make college a country club. Some serious students will go out and try to change society out of all we.
We're probably saying to some extent then that learning must be toward some goal, that we simply can't learn in the abstract without any type of purpose in view? Or is this oblique?
All I'm saying is learning has to be made exciting and relevant and vital. But I don't like the idea of learning toward a goal.
I think that's what we have right now. If you want to say learning in college is toward a goal of a degree in order to work, kind of a thing, that is the goal.
And
you don't have an immediate challenge to a certain course of people, but the whole thing in general becomes just one big mass of things that you've got to get through in order to.
A degree on situation.
Well, why should learning in college be exciting?
Because learning should be exciting in general.
Well, why? You get out in the business world to make a living. In order for this country to exist as a democracy, we have to make a living. And 90% of us, when we get out of college, go into a job which is completely unexciting.
What a crime.
I think that's sad.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
But what are you going to do when you have a million people to do one job?
Well, then at least while you're in college, be excited. Learn, pick up some things that will excite you through life. Education is not for a job, I'm convinced. There are very few jobs that require specialized training. The majority of our students cannot possibly be trained for their jobs. The business curricula in undergraduate institutions is our farces. They are utter, abominable farces. And I've been working them for 10 years. They're the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. It's ridiculous to suppose that these idiotic courses are going to train anybody to be a businessman. But we go through the ritual. These students in business, business students coming to me, and I say, what shall I take? I say, principles of art. Yeah. And if you get educated for life, if you are liberated in your 4 years of college, so that you see possibilities for living, for creative encounter, not with just your job, though I think this will carry over into your job. I don't think business has to be dull. But if college equips you to be an excited person, then learning will be exciting, and you will continue to be excited, or you'll have a much better chance to be excited as you live, as you work.
You're speaking of living, not in your work.
I think college should work to be exciting too.
This is all a big dream, really. Because when you work for a living, you're paid normally by a corporation, and they determine what you do. You don't determine.
Well, but you determine your attitude.
Have you ever heard of 5,000 excited people in one building? Or 10,000 excited people? Well, have you ever gone down into Grand Central Station or down into Chicago and seen 30, 40, 50,000 excited people anxious to get to work? Well, it's ridiculous to think in these terms, then.
No, it isn't. That's not the word.
You're living in a dream world.
There's a real sense, though, in which a person's identity is really, and if what you say is true, it's a real tragedy, because a person thinks of himself, who he is by what he does, very commonly between the ages of maybe 24 and 65. And if his identity conception is I'm sort of a useless, or at least a non-excited or non-productive, or some kind of a cog in society, and that's my identity, it makes it pretty sad. It makes a pretty sad life for him in many other ways, including his family. That's one of the problems that I've noticed and has been written about now so commonly about the role of women in society. That many times all she feels is that she, well really, that her identity, her entire identity is to be someone who does the dishes and takes care of the house while the man does some kind of work. And her identity very commonly becomes that of a very unhappy, non-productive member of society. And when somebody asks her who she is, she says, well, I'm only just a housewife. You know, she doesn't even say I'm only just so-and-so's wife, but it's all a housewife, which kind of modifies her attitude about herself and her family and everything else.
Well, I think John just said the right thing, that part of the big disturbance of students is the fact that they don't want to go from academic excitement to that dull world, you know?
Well,
why?
They're going
prepare
to
for that.
They're going to
I know, but yeah.
It isn't exciting, no. It isn't an exciting future, and in fact, it's getting less exciting all the time.
Well, they don't want to grow up to be the dull minds.
Dull minds.
I'm excited about that in mind.
Dull minds. What do you mean by dull minds? Dull people. What do you mean by dull people?
All people you're talking about in Grand Station going to work, you know.
Yeah.
People who are unexcited. People who are unexcited are unexciting to be around.
When you're youthful, right. As you get older, you become one of these dull tools, too.
Well, I know. I've seen older people who are not excited. And I think Michael Paulson is our university's, one of their real functions in education is to prepare people on how to live, not just on how to make a living. You know? And if you take stuff in art and in literature and music, there are things you can enjoy even if your job is dull.
Instead of looking at thousands of people who are bored by their work, let's look at those few whom we all know who are not. I've got a couple in mind right now. You talk about your corporation called the Kuhn. A friend of mine is the vice president of a very large corporation. He's the chief counsel. He's got a whole crew of attorneys working under him. He's got nationwide responsibility. And he admitted the other day in the meeting, he said, I've got plenty of leisure. I've got all the time I want to take. And he takes it, and he employs it creatively. And he is one of the most excited and exciting people. The I know a couple of them, like a businessman.
You know, I think you're
even taking the man down the totem pole.
That's just what I asked him to say. And I think that's possible too. You know, everybody says, well, maybe if you're rich and head of a corporation, it's exciting. But I have a feeling it's possible to be excited going the other way. And I really don't know what the things right here appreciate in SG&E, but you can look at people even who spend most of their time at Olin Village, you know, in jobs that many people would consider menial. And yet they can be very, very exciting people. And it isn't only in a place like this, but other places too, where a guy might be have a very otherwise, you know, the eyes of the world being a fast and still be very excited and very much alive and feel satisfaction that it would have done too for a special community, whether it might be a janitor. I don't really know any that are especially exciting who are janitors at St. Olaf House, for instance, but I can see it possible that someone here could, you know, be in this environment and feel like he's contributing to the society by what he does. And I know there are people like that.
But in a huge corporation, I mean, it seems like you need to say something. Maybe it is pretty easy to be real excited and greedy. You're your own boss, you're the head of the corporation, you can do what you want to do whenever you want to feel like doing it, you don't have to be responsible for anybody. What about the guy that's standing on the assembly line, whatever he's doing? Now, maybe he can be real creative with his 15-minute coffee break or a half hour, how many times he gets when he's with other people, but how do you be real creative all by yourself, sitting there pushing a nut on a bolt someplace? I think this might be a little bit difficult.
Yeah, you know, sure, not all jobs aren't exciting. All jobs are not exciting, and I'm not trying to say that. But I do not think that, he started talking about businessmen. And I think that a businessman who doesn't find his job exciting is impoverished, because he's not just turning a knife. A businessman has an exciting job. If he fails to find it exciting, it's his fault, or the fault of those who educated him or something. But, you know, everybody talks today about the coming of automation, when the repetitive, boring jobs in which there can be no excitement because there's no opportunity to use your mind, your imagination, these will be disappearing. If this is true, if these jobs will disappear, then there will be opportunity for you. Either people will have more time free from work to employ creatively, or they will be doing things in which they can be creative. And the question arises then, what will these people be doing? Will they be equipped by their education to be excited? Or will they be, will automation free them, as Peter Merrick said, to commit television and go lusting after supermarkets?
Oh. I think that it's all right. Most people expect to be excited from the outside, and I think you have to of yourself accept your position as God's citizen in the world and do the best with whatever you have to do and make the people around you happier. Not that that doesn't have to be your job, but I mean, you are you and you're placed by God in a certain place and you're expected to make the most of it. And if you're going to sit and say, well, I don't like the ironing and I don't like to dust the phone, I don't like to take care of the kids, and that's what you see in most housewives say, I can't be bothered with the meal thing. You're not being square with God. You're not doing the best with what He's given you to do. I don't know what you're thinking on a farm housewife. I still think it's exciting. Yeah, it's